now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Very good.
Dean Haglund, first of all, first order of business, happy birthday.
Hey, that's right. My birthday continues around the globe.
Yeah.
It was technically yesterday in Australia, but today in America.
We are all celebrating here. Throughout North America, your once and future home, we are celebrating Dean Haglund Day.
Yay! Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody, for all the wishes.
I don't know if this is odd or if this makes sense or what, but you know, one of those three boys who live in Pasadena that I used to, you know, take care of when they were growing up.
You went to their plays at high school that you enjoyed so much.
The eldest of those boys shares a birthday with you. And my soon-to-be, follow me on this, I don't know if this is a thing, but the math is right. My soon-to-be stepfather-in-law.
Right? Got it.
Lily's stepdad, my soon-to-be stepfather-in-law, turned 77 on the very day you were celebrating your birthday.
Come on. Yes. That's unbelievable.
So,
and if we go to IMDb, I'm sure there's other celebrities also celebrating their birthday today. So there you go.
I am surrounded by you is my point, though. Did you have a good birthday down there?
Oh, fantastic. Of course, you know, it's a festive time down here because it is a peculiar thing we celebrate in Australia in July. We call it Christmas in July. Where people, because it's dark by 4:30 and a bit chilly, we put up all the Christmas festivities. So it's lights, it's turkey and eggnog. Well, no eggnog, but the menus change. Everybody's bundled in their parkas. And it is. It seems like we're celebrating my birthday in a Christmas theme this year.
Apropos of that, I heard a cute little thing about, you know, somebody complaining because they tried to quit smoking cold turkey. And it's so odd that turkey is the word. I don't understand where that came from. Anyway, I just heard the person ask in response whether they had tried tofurkey instead.
Cold tofurkey.
And I thought that was really funny. Anyway... Dean Haglund, I have a question for you apropos of this conversation. Not really your birthday. I'm not sure this is a gift per se, but certainly of the fact that I am going to have a stepfather-in-law by late February of 2019. And of course, you got your save the date postcard. I handed that to you.
Put
that in your hot little hands, and you and Patty are looking forward to coming out for that, right?
Oh, boy, are we. Yeah, no, for sure.
That's the kind of enthusiasm that inspires me to ask whether or not you would be my best man at the wedding.
What? But, holy shit, I thought you had friends.
Yeah, but we could knock off a podcast this way is what I was thinking.
Yeah. Well, then, if that's the convenience we're looking for,
I mean, it's a Sunday. I mean, between the ritual and the toasts, I mean, that thing's gonna cut itself together. Monday. I mean, that is actually an interesting concern. We will need a podcast the following morning. So,
well, maybe we could do it for your bachelor party at the Pirates.
yes, you remembered. Yes.
Yes.
Friday night, go down to Buena Park, not for the medieval times, but there's the pirate themed medieval times. Yes, absolutely.
Next door to it. Yes. Yeah. No,
Oh my goodness. Suddenly you get a title and you're excited about the pirate themed bachelor party. You were a little nonplussed by it beforehand.
Listen, it's either that or Chuck E. Cheese. Those are your only two.
I know. Right? And don't kid yourself, not bad options.
Right. I'm not eating a pizza, but I'll play the rollerball to win some tickets. I'll do that.
What more do you need? I mean,
I guess.
So
that would be it then. Okay. Yeah, sure.
All right. Good.
I'm best man at this thing.
Yeah.
That means I definitely have to come out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Suit and tie.
So, yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Vintage. Vintage suit and tie.
Vintage inspired would be all right. Yeah. We'll talk.
Sure.
Yeah, we'll talk.
Okay. Excellent. You
know. All right.
I'm in.
We have so much to talk about. I want to start with some follow ups on, and we'll dump this under the heading "Men Behaving Badly."
Okay.
First up, Chris Hardwick, my old friend, whom we spoke about, has found himself, charged on social media or accused on social media of some assault and abuse from women with whom he had relationships in the past. His the results, among other things, were to be fired from AMC. To be dropped at Comic-Con, to have his name removed from the Nerdist website that he helped found.
Right.
Now, his wife came out in support, defending him, saying she doesn't believe it for a minute, as you would expect a wife to do. Judge Roy Moore's wife in Alabama, for example, despite the dozens of people. Bill Cosby's wife, for example. I'm not saying that Chris Hardwick is these men, or that the evidence against him, or the what he is charged with, or anything. I'm just saying we expect this behavior of a wife. It would be much more shocking if the wife said something along the lines of, maybe it happened.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah, that would be terrible too.
So I didn't really think much of that, but the wife is really the story, because she goes public saying he's going to be vindicated and he's going to be back at work and back on television soon. AMC has restored his shows and restored him to his hosting duties on their shows.
Such as
Talking Dead, for example, and Talking with Chris Hardwick. Lots of shows with Talking in the title and Chris Hardwick as the host. And he's back on. And this is following after AMC had the firm of Loeb and Loeb conduct what they termed a thorough and exhaustive investigation. And the results of that investigation are that they do not believe the charges. Now, many people are upset about this, about these women not being believed. This is not a criminal investigation in any way. This is a private firm and a reputable firm. And in this case, a firm that has made $1 billion with a B dollars, $1 billion off their business with the Hearst family.
A media empire.
Exactly. And why do I bring that up, do you think?
Well, because I assume AMC is under the Hearst Corporation?
No, I bring it up because Chris Hardwick's wife is the heir to William Randolph Hearst, Lydia Hearst.
Oh!
Yes.
I did not know that.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now, that does not make her faith in him unfactual. It doesn't mean that he did the things he's accused of. It just is. It certainly makes her interesting, and former model Lydia Hurst, heir to great granddaughter of William Randolph Hurst, the scion of that family. Yes, and it is a peculiar choice for a company to investigate it, I think.
Right.
Because if there's nothing to these charges, then don't you want an independent investigator? Apparently, in our contemporary age, no, we don't want independent investigators because they lead to witch hunts, don't they?
Okay. Well, wait a sec. I mean, independent, but they're also, their reputation would be on the line. So they're not going to fudge stuff, obviously.
They're not.
You're doing the cheapest.
If your reputation is on the line, perhaps, but also your financial bottom line is on the line, which do you choose if those are in conflict with each other? Let's leave that on the table right now, because this becomes a question of conspiracy versus business as usual. And this is why I brought this topic up. Obviously, I hope that these charges against Chris Hardwick are not true. And even if they are, I hope that they were the actions of a man who worked on himself and changed and doesn't do these things, right? Which is also possible. But I do find that element of this, with all these corporate needs and all these different bottom lines, and as we've talked about in the past, this question of is there conspiracy or is there just really business as usual, and the way a business is operated, once you find out, might be shocking, might offend your sense of ethics, but it's not a conspiracy. It's just the way that business operates. And so I give you topic two, which we touched on before, which was the firing of James Gunn from the Marvel Cinematic Universe, the director of the Guardians of the Galaxy movies, the man most responsible not only for the stories told, but for the tone of those pictures, which I think we would agree is one of the main selling points, if not the main selling point of those movies.
And we know that tone is very hard.
Yes. So he got fired because really offensive, questionable, bad taste tweets that he made some 10 years ago, a decade ago, were uncovered. And Disney, upon them being uncovered, Disney fired him. He went public and said, look, they had no choice but to do this because this is a bad reflection upon them. It is interesting that he was fired for these tweets, but these tweets were uncovered in response to political tweets, contemporary political tweets that he made that upset people, in this case, Mike Cernovich. And if you don't know the name Mike Cernovich, God bless you. Keep not knowing the name Mike Cernovich. He is an alt-right white supremacist who was one of the big promoters of the Pizzagate theory. And he is another one who really launched the story that many sites like InfoWars ran with, that buried in those hacked emails from Hillary Clinton was the proof that she ran a child prostitution ring, which, of course, they did not. But so he's the guy that uncovered all this, that drove James Gunn out of a job. And again, it was in response to James Gunn exposing past tweets by political pundit Ben Shapiro. So what this ends up being, of course, and there's a real movement afoot to get James Gunn rehired at Disney. I don't know if that will happen, but it really comes back to this fascinating idea that when we talk about freedom of expression, what is guaranteed by the Constitution is freedom of political expression. And what we have here is two things. Evidence, yet again, that the biggest threat to political expression is not our government, It is corporations.
Right.
And there's no constitutional protection for that. The Constitution protects you from ramifications by the government silencing your political expression.
Right.
And the second thing is that this political expression is when you mix it with comedy, it frightens the hell out of me. It frightens the hell out of me that we may be killing off political satire, among other things.
Oh, you think that's where that's headed?
Well,
so that's satirical.
If a significant pressure can be put on corporations to prevent the distribution and marketing and exhibition and exploitation of political satire, like what corporation that wants to make money would go anywhere near that?
Right. Well, you're right.
And it's not, again, it's not conspiracy. It's just another example of it's business as usual, right?
Yeah.
Companies are going to do the right thing, we hope, if they have really smart CEOs. But they're going to do the right thing if doing the right thing is in their financial best interest.
Right. But also, you know, as I read this book about purpose, about not a mission statement about a business, but what's the business's purpose? What is one's purpose of doing what you do? Why do you set up a corporation? If it's just to make money, generally that will run out of steam sooner or later. There has to be a larger purpose behind it. And if I would think there would be a young company whose purpose is specifically to walk through these weeds, as it were, and support at least political satire in some way. That would be a thing in the future that I could see coming forth. At the moment, I can't visualize it, but I would hope that that's a thing.
So now that brings me to the third and final topic in this subheading of men behaving badly. It involves the longtime head of CBS, Les Moonves.
Mm. Right.
CBS with more programming and less Moonves. that's an old WKRP riff. But as per the failing New York Times, as our president is fond of calling them, Leslie Moonves, the chief executive of the CBS Corporation and one of the most powerful people in the media business, is facing an investigation after a report published revealed allegations of sexual harassment made against him by six women. The CBS board of directors said in a statement that it would investigate any allegations of misconduct and that the claims detailed in an investigative article in The New Yorker would be, quote, taken seriously. Here's the rest of the statement from the company. Upon the conclusion of that investigation, which involves recently reported allegations that go back several decades, the board will promptly review the findings and take appropriate action. Okay, the board plans to hire a law firm to conduct the review. Hey, if you're Les Moonves, you could do a lot worse, apparently, than Loeb and Loeb. But anyway, they will conduct the review before taking action. All right. It would not surprise us. I have no direct knowledge of this. I'm sure you have no direct knowledge of this. But it would not surprise us if someone in Les Moonves' position, who's been there for so long, a la people like Harvey Weinstein, abused their power. That is a all too common trope, is it not?
Right. Very much so. And so, well.
And yet, I would like to point out that, and I'm not muddying the waters with conspiracy, I am just pointing out a coincidence. This is taking place in an era of media mega deals. And as we've talked about on this show, there has been a long-standing attempt to remerge CBS and Paramount. Paramount is owned by Viacom. To remerge CBS and Viacom. And that's what the backdrop is for this investigation into Les Moonves. As per the Daily Beast, and this is fascinating, AT&T recently had an $85 billion acquisition of Time Warner. Disney, a $71 billion purchase of 21st Century Fox's entertainment assets. And yet a knockdown, drag-out fight in Delaware State Court is gumming up the future of two media companies who are going to merge over far more modest stakes. CBS has offered $12 billion for the film and cable conglomerate Viacom that would remerge the two companies that Summer Redstone broke apart in 2005. The holdup is that Viacom wants an additional $2.8 billion and more executive involvement at the recombined company. Sherry Redstone, whose National Amusement owns both of those companies and who took over for her father, wants the two companies to get a deal done ASAP so she can sell the combined entity to a bigger buyer like Verizon or Amazon. So she's trying to recombine her assets so that she can sell them in one package, a la these huge purchase deals. And the holdup involves CBS lowballing Viacom. And as that is going on, the longtime head of CBS finds himself in this hot water.
Wow. And that then becomes a negotiating tool, you think, over...
This would lend the conspiratorial among us to see a conspiracy potentially here, right? And to use talk of conspiracy to defend the man, right? It's a witch hunt.
Right.
It's a witch hunt, with money at the bottom of it. As opposed to what truly is business as usual in this modern corporate world, this kind of shit, if it's real, was going to come out because the opposing sides are researching and investigating the hell out of each other looking for leverage points.
Right. And so they dig up six women who said he was inappropriate at this time, and that comes forward.
A la political campaigns, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Digging up dirt on your opponents. When are you going to do it? When it makes the most sense to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, right?
Yeah. So anyway, is it conspiracy? No. Is it business as usual? Seems like it. Will we ever know what the truth is? Maybe. Who knows? Investigation
right.
Pending, and obviously Les Moonves' response pending. But it is a fascinating time where so many of these charges are coming forward, and they're coming forward, of course, for people in power because they are crimes about power and imposing that power upon other people.
Right.
And yet, as we've talked about in this modern media culture, this modern corporate culture, it's those kind of things affect the bottom line.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, you see it anytime Elon Musk says something weird at a stockholders' phone conference, shares go haywire. Even, you know, there's plenty of examples of where not just, you know, for the man himself, but the entire stock market, as it were, with Facebook having it taken a dive like that. It's it becomes really interconnected, doesn't it?
We have no celebrity deaths in the Chill Pack morgue this week, so it gives us an opportunity to kind of mourn some impending rest in pieces that we're going to be discussing of some of the things that are near and dear to us. How much do we love the history and the architecture and the design of our beloved Clifton's Cafeteria? How much do we love that?
We love that place. Surely that cannot be
And didn't we love it more when they served food?
Yes, they served food. It was a
when it was a cafeteria. Historia. Remember that?
Cafeteria.
So
what do you mean, remember that?
The marketplace. It was still there. The marketplace is no more. And it turns out that the company that came in, bought it, redesigned it, opened all those bars, they had no interest in maintaining it as a marketplace, as a cafeteria. They wanted it to for the array of nightlife venues that they could operate.
Oh, brother.
So it's, they say it's being just redesigned and redone, but it's closed, and who knows if it will ever open, the ground floor marketplace.
Come on. But the bars upstairs are still functioning?
Yes. Yeah.
So they just sealed the restaurant.
Yeah.
The whole thing.
The cafeteria, and, yeah. The dining areas are still open, but, you know, they're open air, so.
Right. So you just go and you drink, and that's where your profit margin is.
And if that weren't enough, and by God, don't you think it ought to be, there's more bad news in downtown L.A., and we knew this was coming.
What?
But, you know, the L.A. Times is now out lock, stock, and barrel of the historic L.A. Times building. For the first time in its 130-year history, the L.A. Times will not have a footprint in downtown Los Angeles. Instead,
right.
The Los Angeles Times is in El Segundo, and which is, by the way, Spanish, meaning the Segundo.
And, thank you.
You know, what's his name? David Simon, was that his name? The creator of The Wire, who before going into TV was a journalist. He recently said that it is the golden age of being a corrupt politician. If you wanted to be a corrupt politician, never mind the old Chicago or, you know, New Orleans and Louisiana, never mind all the graft that went on. The ward bosses, all of those kind of things. Now is the golden age of being a corrupt politician because we have no local news coverage of city governments. And no one's attending these meetings. No one's observing these things. And hence, like, all you get on network news or 24-hour news are these stories about the overarching story affecting maybe the White House or Congress.
Right.
Because, you know, where did they usually get their stories from? They source them from local news, but there is no local news anymore. There are no newspapers from which to source these articles. And so you have entire levels of government operating completely unobserved. And that's what Simon meant by that. And I don't know, you know, look, there were times when the LA Times was not a good paper. There were times in LA where corruption went unchecked. But there was always something viscerally comforting about seeing that giant LA Times edifice right across the street from City Hall. You could at least physically know this is the way it's supposed to be. The Fourth Estate checking the power of the halls of government. And and now they will be doing that from a town called El Segundo. And beyond that, of course, the push is really underway to just demolish that historic building altogether. Yeah, because developers are coming in for condos and they don't want to renovate that building. They want to build a glass high rise.
Yeah, but I saw that that would still incorporate the in the term of architectural sadness. It's called facadism, where you keep the outside but gut the interior to build a modern.
If it doesn't get landmarked, I guarantee you that thing is coming down. So there is a fight afoot to get it landmarked. So not, again, the LA Times in that building, rest in peace. I'll know more about the future of the building in a couple weeks when the longtime communications director of the LA Times, Daryl Kunitomi, speaks about these issues to the Los Angeles Breakfast Club. Finally, a company an application that I had been rooting for because it was just absolutely insane, but had proved to be a disruptor, and I think in some ways potentially the savior of theatrical movie going. MoviePass is breathing its last gasps this weekend. And this was something, for people who don't know, that about a year and a half ago or so launched, and it was an app where you paid $45 a month and you could see unlimited movies. And, but you know, basically they were contracted with like 90, 91% of all theaters in the country. And you could, for your fee, you would use your card and you would be able to check into any 2D screening, not 3D, not IMAX, but any 2D screening of any movie at any time at any theater. But you had to show up to do it. You couldn't order tickets in advance. But what a great deal. What a great deal.
Right.
And nobody was interested in it. So... they lowered it to like $30, and wow, $30. I mean, in LA, that's less than two movie tickets sometimes, right? Like one movie for two people can run more than $30. So what a great deal, and no one gave a damn about that.
I didn't even know that was a thing.
So they lowered it to $20 a month, and you know, some people signed up for it, but for the most part, people didn't give a damn. And so then, last October, I think it was, they launched $9.95 a month unlimited movies, and boom, people gave a damn. So
yeah, I bet.
By the start of this summer, they had 6 million subscribers to it.
Holy smokes.
Yes.
That's a success, a runaway success.
But how do you make money off of it when you are paying full price for every ticket that these 6 million people buy at the movie theaters? How do you make money off of that? And indeed, they're losing like $45 million a month. They've burned through all their cash reserves. The idea all along for them was really they're a data mining company, because they get all your data, but they also are keeping track of all your taste and where you are at any given moment, because you have to be within 100 feet of the theater to check in. So they have a lot of data that could be valuable, and they'd been hoping to partner with people for whom that data was great value, and that has never happened. So here we are, nearing the end of the summer movie season, and it has destroyed them. On Thursday of this week, the app stopped working altogether. They said it was technical difficulties, though, as was reported on Wall Street, they were out of money. They needed an immediate $6 million loan to be able to stay in business. They've stayed in business this weekend and introduced something called surge pricing. It's a new thing. It's still $9.95 a month, but certain showtimes that are of extreme demand, they might charge, as they said, between $2 and $6 per ticket. Well, that in L.A. immediately meant every movie at every theater had a $6 surcharge on it. By today, because yesterday the app stopped working again, by today the surcharge is now $8 on all tickets for all movies, including all the daytime matinees. So if you went and used your app today, you were paying more for that ticket than the theater would have charged.
That's tough.
Yeah. So they are very near death. And again, I learned, I think it was a Business Daily, one of the magazines, maybe it was Wall Street Journal, but reported, did some digging and found out that their parent company has been banned from business in India, where they were founded. They were a tech company that absconded with hundreds of millions of dollars, defrauded every bank in the country and all their shareholders. So suddenly the question is, was MoviePass a Ponzi scheme? And as they got these hedge funds loans in the turn of like $1.2 billion to stay in business, were their principals just hiding that money? And you know, they got the loans on the basis of, look at all the millions of people we've signed up. Look at all the data that we have. That's going to be valuable to somebody. And all these hedge funds said, yeah, I bet that would be. Here's $1.2 billion. There's $1.2 billion that goes into offshore accounts. And oh, we still can't pay our bills and we're going to go out of business. So it's going to be interesting. But what is sad about it is it really, after years of movie attendance going down, movie attendance is going back up because it is reminding people how much fun going to the movies is and how many good movies are out there. And it has been the best friend to so many independent films and documentaries. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I got to ask you, because we're halfway through the show, and on several occasions I've been deafened by this. Are you shooting caps at something every 45 seconds or a minute?
No.
Okay.
What do we hear? Oh, is this the creaking of my hardwood floor?
Possibly. There's something very loud that, that
like,
was it.
Like that?
That was it, yeah.
That was it?
Sometimes
that you're hearing.
Sometimes it's peeking into the red, so I'm sure our listeners are going to enjoy that.
Oh, my God.
And you can send your letters, care of Dean Haglund, to Sydney,
you
Australia.
You can help you can repair the hardwood floor on this house that's sinking into the mud.
You're leaving. What the hell do you care?
I know.
Christmas in July. Okay. And Christmas in July is ruined by the creaky hardwood floors. So anyway.
In fact, I've seen, I'm going to see Screech tonight. That's how much Christmas is happening here.
Live play or the Bill Murray movie? What are you saying?
The Bill Murray movie.
Okay.
I've never seen it, actually.
Oh, it's fun. It's good fun. Back off, big man. That's my favorite line in it. When he's trapped in an elevator with one of the ghosts of, I think, Christmas Future. Back off, big man, he says. All right.
Great. Spoiler alert, maybe.
So that's the sad, strange tale of MoviePass. Now,
that's sad and strange.
We segue into movies. One of the movies that no one with MoviePass has been able to see this weekend because it was completely blacked out is the new Mission Impossible. Mission Impossible Fallout, the sixth in the series, the largest opening ever for one of these movies, the largest opening in Tom Cruise's career, the longest of the Mission Impossible movies, the first Mission Impossible movie to get an A Cinema Score grade.
What?
The best reviewed of any of the Mission Impossibles, though for my money, Dean Haglund, maybe the third best of them, but a very, very good movie. It's not as good as that Ghost Protocol, which I think still is the high point. I also think J.J. Abrams' Part 3, which revitalized it and started in media re with that fantastic showdown between their best villain they've ever had, Philip Seymour Hoffman, and Tom Cruise,
right.
That probably is better. But the point is, what a reliable franchise, and the last four have all been really, really good. In fact, the only one that is worthless is the second one, directed by John Woo, and that, until this one, I think this will pass it, but it still is the biggest hit of all of them in the U.S., interestingly enough.
Really?
Yeah.
That's weird. Because I know that was a lot of hype, too. I mean, John Woo was an exciting director, newly discovered. I mean, it all timed out correctly. But I remember being highly disappointed by that.
Well, it felt like a parody of a John Woo film.
It's
really
like he was looking at his own films and doing a mockery of it.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting that, three is really revitalizes it after having John Woo, action auteur, Brian De Palma, auteur. Part 3 is J.J. Abrams fresh off Alias, needing to prove himself. Part 4, which the high point, I think, is Brad Bird making his first live-action film. And now we have Chris McQuarrie, who's no auteur, did the Jack Reacher movies with Tom Cruise, but who has been working diligently behind the camera, I think, to escape the shadow he cast for himself as the Oscar-winning screenwriter of The Usual Suspects. And of course, quite frankly, I think he's a more reliable director than Bryan Singer. Of course, the joke would be, of course he's more reliable because Bryan Singer literally goes missing, as he did on that Queen shoot. But anyway, so quite the crowd pleaser. And and 56 years old. Tom Cruise is 56, 34 when he starts in this. And I saw something written that the Mission Impossible franchise might be the most reliable action franchise that Hollywood has ever developed. Because you think James Bond, but that was developed in England, right? So
right. And what about Terminator? I guess that wasn't...
That kind of fell off the shelf, didn't it?
Kind of fell off the shelf, yeah, towards the end. So, you're right, this is reliable. Because every time he's, kicked out of the agency and he has to fight on his own, I mean, isn't that every plot of you're no longer in the agency and I'm coming down to kill you. Well, there's so everybody's after him.
There's always some reason he can't trust them. He's always working on the outside right. because there's some reason he can't trust them. That's true to all right. of them, all those kind of twists. But it really is interesting how they've developed such a nice formula for themselves, how they really have made it back over these last few films truly into a team dynamic, which is what was great about the old show. One thing they've done really smart that has kind of been a little bit of an Achilles heel on the Bond films of late is they have just gradually revealed a mythology for Tom Cruise's Ethan Hunt character to continue to make him in some ways more important as a linchpin while at the same time developing the team dynamic. So it's right. really been quite brilliant how they have unfolded these and knowing what the appeal is and continuing to augment and improve these films in ways. I was amused by something that Alex Lefchuk over on Siren FM, the Midweek Drive, pointed out to me, which was what he saw as overt similarities to Roger Moore's final James Bond film, A View to a Kill. And they both open in Paris, a lot of action in Paris. They both involve right. flooding a canyon with nuclear blasts, irradiating it with nuclear blasts. And both lead actors are 56. Though in the case of Tom Cruise, it's a better looking 56 than Roger Moore's 56 Roger Moore. In A View to a
Kill. Yeah, I don't think it was working out and doing... doing the yoga classes.
But what's interesting is I then go back and rewatch Mission Impossible 3, and I suddenly see these similarities to Timothy Dalton's final outing of License to Kill.
And shut up.
And sure enough, Tom Cruise is the same age in Mission Impossible 3 that Timothy Dalton was in License to Kill. So now I've got this whole thing I want to go through, and I want to try to figure out if there is a parallel to specific Bond films with the Mission Impossible films. And in both these cases, we're talking about Bond films that didn't really perform up to muster. And how great. What better to steal from than the lesser-loved Bond films? Because you'll get away with stealing from those, especially right. if the movies that you're making are good. But if you steal from a great film, now you're putting yourself in an unenviable position. Because people will remember right. it. Yeah.
That's like, wait a sec. This is beloved. This movie's beloved, whereas one is like, a lot of things screwed up. So not everybody remembers Timothy Dalton's View to a Kill. I can't even think of the plot line off the top of my head. So why not put that into...
In the old days, as you know, there would be counter-programming at the multiplexes, often involving comedy. And we've had some comedies here that I want to talk about that are independent in nature.
Yes.
And you've seen one that I want to hear about in just a moment. But never was I made to feel with remorse again the lack of mainstream Hollywood support behind comedies than when I attended on Monday night at the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences a 30th right. anniversary celebration for Hairspray. If you had guessed in the 80s that John Waters would one day be feted at the Academy, you would have been fit for a straitjacket, probably.
Right.
But right? Here we are, John Waters with his entire cast on stage, one of my favorite screening ever. The panel discussion was beautifully moderated by Oscar-winning filmmaker Barry Jenkins, who made Moonlight. The right? Stories that the cast told, the love they expressed for each other, fascinating stuff. It was clocked to the minute, and the panel discussion was beforehand, which was great.
Wow.
And I learned a couple great things. First of all, when John Waters was inducted into the Academy, his sponsor was David Lynch.
Fantastic.
And
that's hilarious.
And it's hilarious, and yet beautiful, and mm-hmm. and yet sort of ironic, given that John Waters is quite a few years ahead of Lynch in terms of their careers, right? John right. Waters is making features in the late 60s and early 70s, while David Lynch is still in art school.
Right.
But there are some similarities between those guys, a certain kindred nature, I would think. But
yeah.
But what I loved was I remember seeing Hairspray when it came out, and I remember thinking, well, this is the least John Waters of his movies up until this point. But what is interesting is, looking back at it, I now realize I've been looking back at an altered memory, a memory altered by the Hairspray musical, and by the Hairspray movie musical, and by the live television musical version of Hairspray, which all were like photocopies of photocopies of photocopies. They got blurrier and blurrier and blurrier. And what I forgot was the real rage fueling the original Hairspray. The energy is so nonstop and infectious, and the man who made it was angry about a lot of things culturally, and he used this frothy, energetic musical to make you think about it. And as he described it, it was his Trojan horse.
Oh.
He got into mainstream America, and then all of a sudden, all these issues that were within the film exploded in these communities that had embraced the film. Not only, of course, does it lead to him making the most money he's ever made in his career, especially with all these remakes, but it really, in some ways, served to be his most subversive movie. He, in fact, said John Waters, referring to himself in third person, John Waters, at that point in his career, making a PG movie was the most John Waters thing in any John Waters movie.
Nah. That's hilarious.
Yeah. It's a brilliant, brilliant, funny movie. And I can't wait to watch it again.
I know. You know, now that you say that, it's been so long, and I'm blurring pictures of John Travolta.
Yes.
Which he was never in the original, but it's like,
so Divine plays two roles in it, but plays Tracy's mom in it. And he, what you love about him is, it's a man playing this character, but he's actually playing Tracy's mother. And Travolta's commenting all over it.
Yeah, for sure.
So it's actually touching. Yeah. And Ricky Lake, dear God, what a national treasure he discovered in her. So some of the best dialogue, too. I mean, delivered by the likes of Pia Zadora, of all people, Let's Get Naked and Smoke. I mean, my God, the dialogue in this is terrific. The movie is so funny. And there was a time when we got movies like this released by studios as counter programming, and they put their money behind them.
Now it goes to Netflix.
Yeah, exactly. Though, a comedy, I'm betting, in theaters.
I did see a comedy in theaters, and holy smokes, was this a souffle that never collapsed on itself and didn't end in a car chase? I'm talking about a movie called The Breaker Uppers out of New Zealand, starring this. They're two female comedians, hilarious, Jackie Van Beek and Madeline Sammy. I'm sure they've done many other things, but they play two women who run an agency that break up couples when one or the other can't do it themselves. And man, the dialogue, it's funny. It's just crackles off the screen. And maybe I'm very used now to the Aussie accent, but so I could understand it all. Maybe if I was not attuned to the accent, I might miss some of the dialogue, but it is really funny. And to see from Flight of the Conchords, Jermaine Clement's holy smokes funny cameo as a Tinder date. Oh my God. I love this thing. And it was so, it was so light. And following the very thing Steve Kaplan, guest of our show, talked all about, you know, comedy having there's actual structure. There's actual things you can do to comedy to make comedy happen, right? He teaches that in his workshop. And this movie follows a lot of that to a T. You know, the scene, of course, the girls fight and then they have a makeup scene, and they put the makeup scene in a grocery store in front of a cash register clerk who they keep saying, "Can we have a moment?" And she keeps saying, "No, I'm working here. This is my station. If I leave, I get fired." So this third person has to be in the scene that just makes that hilarious. So I loved it. I think it's going to show up on Netflix in the U.S. So take a look for it on your screens, however you do it.
I hope I hope that it gets a theatrical release. I'm looking into this as soon as we're done with the show. The Breaker Uppers. What a great premise! I can't believe that this premise was sitting out there unexplored.
I know, right? Even that, like the opening scene is a woman bawling her head off, and the two are posed as police officers. Oh my God, sipping tea as this woman's just crying that her husband's gone missing.
We have so many films and TV shows about matchmakers, and there was even that series, The Finder of Lost Loves. I mean, yes. Imagine this, a TV show, The Ruiner of Found Loves.
I know, right?
Because I used to have this phrase about people who were in relationships a lot. And, you know, especially when I loved both the people. And but I had this phrase that all too often would come to mind, which is, you know, both these people deserve better. And like, what if that was the mantra for a guy who walked through the world, yeah. You know?
Right. Yeah. You both deserve better. So get out of this relationship. Right. It's so good. This thing is so good. And it went so fast. I mean, you know, it's one of those things when the movie's over, you go, oh, my gosh, I could sit through that whole thing again. Because there were so many moments in there.
And you're saying that it's female driven, too, which is even better. Yeah. Because this would be I keep saying a guy, you know, and because that's historically, yes. You know, like Finder of Lost Loves was a man. It needs to be women. It would be altogether just awful if it was men.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Men would just be creepy. Yeah, that's right. And in fact, I think they address that in the movie as well. So go check this out. I loved it. You know, it's it just tickled me. And in terms of, you know, maybe I've been watching too many Bollywood comedies lately on the plane or you know, I rewatched Anchorman 2. There's a heaviness to these other comedies, right? That you're trying to punch those jokes through and shove them down your throat. And here's a setup gag and blah, blah, blah. Whereas this thing is just the opposite. It seems to be like improvisationally based where everything is effervescent. You know, how it's shot, it's just how it's the dialogue comes off, some of the simplicity of the staging of gags. It's amazing, actually. I was actually shocked at the end of it, going, what the hell? How did this premise, these actors, how has all of this been under my radar all this time being down here? Even though I'm not living in New Zealand, I, you know, just came upon this as a trailer and then said, oh, that looks like fun. And was kind of blown away.
There is a comedy here that has been getting great acclaim, and I've delayed talking about it for a while, even though I saw it right when it came out, because I really wanted to find a way to bring myself around to be positive. about it.
Uh-oh.
Because,
what are we talking about?
Because, as we know, there aren't enough opportunities for comedic voices to find their flourishing in big screen feature-length motion.
That's true.
It's something that you have to work at to get to perfect that voice, right? And and if they're not given a chance, how is that ever going to happen? And so I'm glad that people have championed this film. It's called Sorry to Bother You. It's the first film from hip-hop artist Boots Riley. And it's set in an alternate reality of present-day Oakland, California, where a telemarketer, Cassius Green, finds himself in this bizarre universe when he discovers a magical key that leads to material glory. And it's basically to unleash your inner white person. And and the voice roles get recast for these characters when they unleash the inner white person that allows them to achieve corporate material success, and brings Cassius under the sway of his evil cocaine snorting CEO Steve Lift. Played by a never more relevant Armie Hammer, actually. It's kind of the thing that's the role that you want to see him in. Now, this movie, here I am. I'm going to be the bizarre Hollywood guy who says, oh, it's like this, only this. It is a modern urban office space at its best. And it works best when it's that. And I wish it had courage to stay that instead of feeling that it needed to become an urban naked lunch. So
that's the real.
They lose control of their tone, and they go for some big third act action stuff. And but like I said, I felt that criticizing it misses the point, which is. Satire is so hard, and it's funny. You're gonna laugh a lot through it. It also might exhaust you, but you know, again, it's something to be celebrated and championed, if only because you get the feeling that the people who made this are really filmmakers to watch. It stars Lakeith Stanfield, Tessa Thompson, Danny Glover, and like I said, Lamar, Armie Hammer. Lakeith Stanfield, I've been talking about on this show, it seems, quite often, increasingly often over the last few years. His first film role was in Short Term 12, a script that brought, the Oscar-winning actress Brie Larson. From Room, brought her to prominence.
Oh, yeah.
It was the first major film role for Rami Malek, who would become famous for Mr. Robot. So the person who cast that movie, Short Term 12, that independent film, knew what they were doing. Lakeith Stanfield, played a major role in Get Out. He starred in Crown Heights. He had a major supporting role in Snowden. He played Snoop Dogg in Straight Outta Compton. And he is the lead in this, and he can carry a motion picture, my friend. This guy is the real deal and a movie star for a long time to come, I hope.
Wow. This is exciting.
I saw two other comedies, and one of them fits into that discussion we were having about what happens when an audience likes a movie far less than the critics do. What does it mean? And there is another movie like this. It's a movie called Hotel Artemis, which
Don't know this at all.
Interesting that you don't know this, because it's a 2018 dystopian action thriller, as it's described, written and directed by Drew Pearce in his directorial debut. It stars Jodie Foster, Sterling K. Brown, Emmy winner, Sterling K. Brown, Sophia Boutella from The Kingsman, Jeff Goldblum, Dave Bautista, Zachary Quinto, So a pretty impressive cast. The plot, and it's very reminiscent in some ways, as was that movie Upgrade I talked about a couple years ago from Australia. Very reminiscent of like John Carpenter's early 80s works. It's set in a near future, and it follows a character played by Jodie Foster, who's a nurse who runs a secret hospital for criminals in this near future Los Angeles. And the movie takes place one night during a riot that blacks out downtown. It has received mixed praise from critics. I think right now the Rotten Tomatoes stands at 60%, so a barely a recommend. But you might expect that from kind of this 1980s-esque sci-fi action suspense drama comedy action thriller, right? But the audience has approved of it to a tune of 31%. And
wow, now that's
odd, isn't it? I mean, and the comments are so horrible about it. And, like, I didn't get what I... And it's literally what we talk about, though. I didn't get what I signed up for. All it was talk. Because it really, what it is it uses that premise to be kind of a darkly comedic character exploration.
Which
and
I would expect. When they were thinking it would be San Andreas...
Well, no, I think they thought it would be more of a... kind of maybe more Tarantino-esque with the darkly comedic character stuff punctuated by elaborate and thrilling action. And and the action is almost the way it's choreographed, the way it's blocked is almost so that you can never see it because it's not what they're interested in, but it is to a degree what they market it.
Yeah. Well, no, I want to see this. This sounds fascinating.
It is fascinating. It is a failure. I do think it's a failure, but it's a damn fascinating failure.
Those are my favorite.
Kind of an inspiring failure in
well, this in is way. The thing, isn't it? We learn from our failures, and as armchair directors, this is exactly what we look for. When you see something that has a glimmer, and you go, oh, where did they misstep on that?
Yeah.
So now I'm going to go find this thing.
And also as a lesson to filmmakers, you've got to fight the good fight where your marketing is concerned. It might be all well and good that they are going to maximize how many butts are in the seats, but if those people feel they are not getting the movie they signed up for, it's going to ultimately be to the movie's detriment, not to the movie's financial success. And to your career's detriment, too, because I think you can get painted by that brush as a filmmaker where people will go, I didn't get what I expected of that movie, and they're going to think that about you in the future.
That they're going to, exactly. This guy doesn't deliver what the movie promises, or he can't deliver, even worse.
Meanwhile, one other kind of comedy story I wanted to share with you was I went to see an independent dark comedy called Eat Me, and it's directed by Adrian Alex Cruz. And you may not know that name, Dean Hagman.
Well,
Alex Cruz. But Adrian Alex Cruz is a very accomplished theater director here in Los Angeles. But you may be most familiar with him, Dean Hagland, because he played the villain in a movie called Karl Rove, I Love You.
And come on.
He has directed this dark comedy feature film called Eat Me that is written by and starring Jacqueline Wright, a real stage royalty here in Los Angeles, and it's based on her play. And her play was pretty renowned and pretty shocking. It's a kind of a stream of consciousness of her dark thoughts, this play. It's not for everyone's taste, but and at times it struggles in its transition from play to film, but oh my God, the fact that they go the places they go, is it so delightful? And just the exuberant expression of our darkest human thoughts, expressed exuberantly with joy, even, wow. is somehow just so cathartic given the age in which we live. So
these dark, anxious times.
Anyway, another way to explore your own, a comedic voice. Put it on stage. Work it out on stage.
What?
Right? This is an age-old method, and there's ever more reason to do it now than ever before because it's easier for filmmakers to afford the means of making movies. Go. Work your story out on stage. Work the...
Absolutely.
Explore the characters on stage, and then adapt it for the screen and work with the people who brought it to life on stage.
That is the model of Big Fat Greek Wedding. That was a 6-year show done at comedy festivals around the world.
And dare I say some of your favorite comedies of the old vaudeville / early sound era?
Absolutely. That's where all your talent came from, working it out, touring by train, doing 10 shows a week.
Well,
across the country.
That brings us to an end of another interesting audio-challenged episode of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Sorry it was audio-challenged. That's so weird. You're not hearing the creaking.
No, not anymore. I'm not hearing that.
Yeah.
No. But I stopped listening to you like 30 minutes ago.
So.
You can find every installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com. Download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
But write a review if you like.
What could be more fun? Can people like us on Facebook, Dean?
Please like us. Oh, my gosh. We're at Facebook.com at Chill Pack Hollywood. And you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram using the exact same handle. It's at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and.
Of course it is. And people can write us. Chill,
oh, sure.
ChillPackHollywood@yahoo.com. That's C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K Hollywood@yahoo.com. We'd love to talk about what you want us to talk about. It's one of the things we mean when we say it's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
That's right. And now I'm going to go online and thank everybody for all the birthday wishes that they sent me on every platform that I possibly exist in right now. So that will be my entire day taken up doing that.
That's my best man, Dean Haglund. I'm Phil Lernis. Talk to you next week.
See ya.
Belated spoiler alert.